From Michigan Public, this is Stateside. I'm April Baer. Today on the show, what's in the name of a Great Lake? More than you might think.
This is, in my mind, erasure. When you start just taking name away, stripping name, which is identity, which is purpose, which is home.
Also, how Michigan is trying to boost post-secondary education by breaking down barriers for students.
Folks who think they can't afford college often fill out the FAFSA and find out they're Pell eligible, which would pay for any community college in the state.
And the former owner of a beloved Ypsilanti ice cream shop talks about dessert bringing people together.
Two folks who probably wouldn't talk to each other normally at a farmer's market, if I was giving them both free samples of my sweet brown butter ice cream, suddenly they were both talking about their grandmothers, right? Like they were sharing stories about what the flavor reminded them of.
All that coming up on today's Stateside. Welcome to Stateside. I'm April Baer. Today, we're talking ice cream, Michigan ice cream, and dreams of making ice cream and sharing that deliciousness with others.
People loved the flavors, but they were also like, oh my gosh, I have a guy, you know, with ice cream.
That end of summer conversation is coming up later in the show. But first, we want to take you back to last year, when an Afghan immigrant shot at two National Guardsmen in Washington, D.C., killing one of them. The Trump administration responded with a new travel ban. It isn't just keeping people from dozens of countries out of the United States. It's also blocking applications for work permits and citizenship for people who are already here in the U.S. Michigan Public's Beenish Ahmed reports on how the ban upended life for one man in Metro Detroit.
Days after the National Guardsman shooting, Azizul got a notice. It instructed him to report to the ICE office for a check-in. Even though he had recently gotten married to a U.S. citizen, he was nervous.
I was thinking if they arrest me and send me back to Afghanistan, it will be too difficult. Maybe I lose my life.
Instead of getting sent back home, Azizullah was detained and sent to the North Lake Processing Center. We're only using his first name because of retaliation he might face for sharing his story. Azizullah's lawyer, Sam Kulhonik, asked ICE officers why he was being detained.
He has a pending appeal. He's married to a U.S. citizen. We're in this process. The answer was just kind of, you know, we have orders from headquarters. And so it seemed very targeted.
Kulhonik filed a habeas petition to ask for Azizullah's release. Government lawyers said he should stay in detention based on the administration's mandatory detention policy. But they didn't give any reasons specific to him. After spending 2 months in Northlake, a judge quickly granted Azizullah the lowest possible bond.
And that just showed me that, like, this was somebody who never should have been detained in the first place.
After the National Guardsman shooting, President Trump had made a televised address.
We're not going to put up with these kind of assaults on law and order by people who shouldn't even be in our country. We must now reexamine every single alien who has entered our country from Afghanistan under Biden.
Trump had already banned travel from Afghanistan. Then his administration stopped processing green cards and holding citizenship ceremonies for Afghans who were already here. A judge said the pause is illegal, but the Trump administration hasn't lifted it. All of those changes made Azizullah think of the new laws the Taliban imposed since they returned to power.
You cannot predict anything. New government, new policies, new rules, new laws, and every day you should be updated. Otherwise, you didn't know what is going on.
Azizullah had never thought about leaving Afghanistan. He responded to its hardships with positive efforts. His sister was killed in 2018 when ISIS bombed a test prep center. Azizullah's family started a library to honor her memory and encourage other girls to keep studying. After he lost classmates in an ISIS-claimed attack on his university in 2020, he started a cycling club. Azizullah wanted to connect with different people to learn about the challenges they faced.
All those activities which I was doing to plan to get more and more with the pupil and getting like going to be a senator, yeah.
That hope of becoming a senator came crashing down when the Taliban returned to power in 2021.
Yeah, that was so hard for me. I was thinking about my dream, everything. Oh, everything is finished.
when he heard that the Biden administration had made it easier to file for asylum, Azizullah came to the U.S. and put in his application. He moved to Michigan because he had an old friend here. His brother and sister-in-law soon followed him. Azizullah married his friend's sister. This summer, they celebrated their wedding reception with hundreds of people. He hopes they can take a honeymoon soon.
But for now, I cannot plan to travel, but I hope that one day we can travel all over the world and we can help each other to make a better society.
Azizullah wanted to run for public office in Afghanistan. Now, he's focused on doing whatever good he can here in Michigan.
We've become aware of a proclamation suggesting a new name for the lake that some of us call Ontario. Of course, the lake already has a much older name, Niigaani-Gitchigami. Eric Hemingway directs the humanities program for the U of M School for Environment and Sustainability. He's also a citizen of the Little Traverse Bay Band of Odawa Indians. Can you tell us anything about the relationships between people who live in you know, the place that we can now call Michigan and the other regions around the Great Lakes? I mean, how do you describe that relationship between different tribes?
Well, I see it this way, that land environment is the one thread through many various distinct tribal sovereign nations. You know, there's different views of politics and economics and whatnot, but when it comes to land environment, all the tribes that I've ever talked to and had experiences with, that's home. Whether you're in a mountain, a river, by the ocean, this is your home. You've been here since time immemorial. You've been here forever. And the Anishinaabe, the Odawa, Ojibwe, Potawatomi, together in Anishinaabe, Kichigumik, the Great Lakes is home. Now, there are other tribes in the Great Lakes. I will not say we're the only one. There's many tribal nations in the Great Lakes, whether it's Haudenosaunee, Iroquois, Nipissing, Ho-Chunk, Menominee, and we all have different views and different names for these places. So we've never left as Odawa. We've never left, you know, this area called Gitchigumik. And when it comes to relationship to this place, it goes back thousands of years. Whether it's, like I said, Haudenosaunee, also known as League of Iroquois, or a Ho-Chunk. Like Haudenosaunee, Iroquois are over, you know, in New York, and the Ho-Chunk are in Wisconsin. You know, two vastly different areas of the Great Lakes, two very different tribal nations, but they, you know, share this home that we call, you know, Gitchigumik.
I guess it's natural for people to, when they come to a new place, you know, they kind of have their own impressions of it, and they may develop their own names for it. But it certainly seems as though the naming of this body of water as Lake Ontario came with a certain number of assumptions, too. Do you think something is lost when we don't know the history and naming of places around us that, as you say, have not just been a place where people have lived for 100 years since the coming of Europeans to the area, but several thousand years?
Absolutely. I mean, this is, in my mind, erasure. When you start just taking name away, stripping name, which is identity, which is purpose, which is home of these places, and you just start labeling it in these totally different names. So this has, in my mind, as a historian and also as an Anishinaabe person, a really big effect. You know, you start losing the original identity of a place. You start losing the original story of a place when you just start stripping name away. And I keep going back to my own home, because that's my home at Cross Village. You know, Cross Village is a new name for that place. The old name is Onwetikamek. And it's part of this region called Wauganuxing, Land of the Crooked Tree. And it's not Emmett County. It's not Michigan. It's Wauganuxing. And that's been that way for thousands of years, not hundreds. And you go down south and, you know, these different communities have different names for their places. So then once you change a name to a different language, you know, a different meaning, slowly over time, the original identity just fades away into the background. But it never fades completely. That's what I want to say, is that that name, that identity is always going to be there, and people will start to look for that. And we're seeing a lot of Anishinaabe people throughout the Great Lakes have this really big surge in language revitalization of Anishinaabemowin, and they're looking at place names. So you can, you know, label it this, label it that, but you can't eradicate the identity of a place wholesale.
Eric, is there anything that maybe you'd like to share with folks who are just trying to get their heads around a new name and whether or not this is going to actually stick?
You can put a label on top of a label on top of a label. And over time, though, I think, you know, the labels will start to erode a bit. Like, I live in a place, like I said, Emmett County. It's on the maps. It's in the census records. But you talk to other Anishinaabe people, other Odawa people, it's like, oh, that's Wagonuxing. So you could do this, but it's going to find its way out. And just because, you know, one party or one person wants to name something differently, that doesn't, you know, bode for everybody around this massive body of water on both sides of the border. These names are ancient, like Lake Superior. You know, one of our ancestors, a Siganak, he's an Odawa war chief from Wagonuxing. During the War of 1812, he was being interviewed by Henry Schoolcraft and the Indian agent from Michigan. And he's like, oh, that's you know, Lake Chippewa, the Ojibwe Lake, because they all live up there. And Lake Huron is Lake Odawa, Ottawa Lake, because we all live here. That's just a reminder, you know, that these names are still there. And you could talk to, you know, a person from a different tribe, and they're going to have, you know, a different take on this lake. It's going to have a different name, but that name is different because it goes back so far. You know, this predates America by thousands of years. That says something.
Eric, thank you so much for helping us get a little context for the way we call things. We appreciate it.
I appreciate you bringing me on and just sharing your space on this Friday morning.
Miigwech.
Miigwech.
Pashkenozhek, kinozhek, kinebegomegok namek, mara oking zibi. Ejimash koziek mara ojiang.
The voice you're hearing is Professor Margaret Noden, scholar and translator at the University of Wisconsin-Milwaukee, sharing a song that was written for the north shore of Nigani Gichigami. It's time for a break now. After that, reframing post-collegiate work for Michigan students. You're with Stateside. This is Stateside. I'm April Baer. Michigan is racing toward its goal for 60 by 30. It's an effort to make sure that 60% of Michiganders hold a post-secondary credential by the year 2030. But the path to that future depends a lot on whether people can actually get through the door. With us now is Ryan Fewins-Bliss, Executive Director of the Michigan College Access Network, or MCAN. Hey, Ryan, good to have you.
Hi, so great to be here.
Also joining us today is Angel Griffith. She's taking advantage of one of the state's initiatives to get a post-secondary degree and is a student at MSU right now. Angel, hi.
Hi, thank you for having me.
Well, Ryan, could we start with you? Can you tell me a little bit about 60-30, how it started and how it fits in with other things MCAN is working on right now?
Yeah, about the time when Governor Whitmer took office here in Michigan, she sort of looked around to the other states to see what they were doing around education and workforce development and saw that we were one of maybe seven states in the nation that didn't have a college attainment goal. And that actually was affecting some of our ability to get funding into the state. So one of the first things she did when she took office was named the 60 by 30 goal, 60% of Michigan residents having a degree or certificate by the year 2030, as a rallying cry for the state, as a formal goal that we all could work to achieve based on the economic needs of the state. At the time, about 60% of Michigan residents needed a certificate or a degree to fill our economic needs. We've grown beyond that now. We're probably around 70, 72% in the current market. But the goal remains the same as a rallying cry across the state for folks to move toward.
Yeah. Angel, can we move from the general that we just talked about with Ryan to your specific experience? Do you mind telling us a little bit about what your high school experience was like and maybe what your expectations were for the time after senior year?
Yes. High school, we didn't have a lot of funding at my school because it wasn't a public school. So we didn't have a lot of programs like AP classes or things that could get us like a leg up. The only thing we really had was like dual enrollment. So I was kind of worried about that aspect. And I was a little worried about my family's financial situation, just in the fact that I knew that I would be getting state money, like money from the state, but I didn't know how I was going to cover the rest, other than like getting a job or something, trying to pull stuff together with my family.
I mean, college debt is a thing for so many Americans and Michiganders. It's understandable that would be a worry. Angel, I understand that you were part of this project that gives scholarships called Ticket to Tuition. How did you find out about this?
Yes. So in high school, I was a part of a program called Upward Bound, which was like a program to get students ready for college after high school or any higher education that they wanted to go into. So it was towards the end of my senior year, and I was applying for scholarships, and one of my mentors from the program said, "Did you guys apply to this scholarship?" And I said, "I don't even know what that scholarship is." And he's like, "I just need you guys to apply to this. Like, I don't know how it works or anything, but just apply to it and see if you get it." So he told us to apply. I texted the number like the instruction said. And then a few months later, I got an email saying that I got the scholarship. I told my family, and we were like just thanking God, because that's what we had been praying for, like for a while, just like having enough money to get through the rest of college.
Sure. Ryan, I know that Ticket for Tuition is just one aspect of things that you're doing with 60 by 30. But can you explain how Ticket for Tuition works?
Yeah, this is really a brainchild of Senator Sean McCann, who represents the Kalamazoo area. He really wanted to come up with a program to incentivize students to fill out the FAFSA, the Free Application for Federal Student Aid. In Michigan, we've done a really good job of aligning all of our state-based scholarships and grants to the federal form. So when you fill out that federal form, not only are you applying for your federal aid, you're applying for your state aid, as Angel was talking about, and also a lot of times institutional aid at your college. And so we really wanted a program that would get more people to fill out the FAFSA, because what we find is that folks who think they can't afford college often fill out the FAFSA and find out they're Pell eligible, which would pay for any community college in the state, or their community college guarantee eligible, which is the free community college program in Michigan, or other scholarships that actually, in their mind, they have ruled out college because of the cost. And lo and behold, Michigan has made it either free or much more affordable for you. And so we launched Ticket to Tuition. We were able to give away almost $1 million. It was 40 awards at $10,000 and 10 awards at $50,000. Angel got one of the $50,000 awards. We're so proud of her. And so thousands, tens of thousands of students filled out the FAFSA for the first time. They were entered into this drawing. We randomly drew the names, and Angel was one of them, along with a bunch of other students across the state who all had similar stories to Angel, like want to go to college, ready for the next stage of my life and to go into the workforce, but really worried about the cost.
Just stunning. Ryan, can you talk about some of the issues? I mean, Angel gave us an idea that, you know, this is just, it's a big financial commitment for families who may, you know, whether you're talking about a four-year college or sometimes even community college or professional, other kinds of professional programs, you know, money is just an issue. Can you talk about some of the issues that 60 by 30 is designed in mind with for to address?
Yeah, 60 by 30 is again that rallying cry, that goal that we need to get more people into and through college. And what we have figured out is there's a lot of barriers. Cost is the obvious barrier, especially when affordability is such an issue around everything these days. If you're worried about how you're going to buy your hamburger and milk and eggs, you can't even imagine what paying for college would look like. And so that's usually the number one barrier that people identify. Governor Whitmer and the legislature, including Republican leaders in the Michigan House, have done a great job of working together to increase our state-based financial aid by hundreds of millions of dollars. There is more money in Michigan for state-based college financial aid than there has ever been in the past. There has never been a more affordable time in the state of Michigan to go to college. We have not solved the affordability issue, but boy, we took a real hard punch at it. What we found, though, when we sort of opened the hood of the other barriers was, while affordability was the easily identifiable barrier, there was a bunch of other stuff that were actually barriers for students too. Things like housing insecurity, food insecurity, childcare if they were a parent, transportation. Things that are sort of basic needs support that even if you give a student $50,000 like Angel, we know there's other barriers that we've got to help these students tackle as well. So our colleges have been doing this, our high schools have been doing this, our communities, our philanthropic agencies, and our governments all across the state have been trying to figure out how they tackle these other barriers to make sure, again, that a student can get in, but that they stay, persist toward completion, and then get that certificate or degree.
Angel, can you tell us a little bit about how you used the money that you received?
Yes. So, since I got the state scholarship of like FAFSA and Michigan Achievement and such, I didn't have much to pay for when it came to paying the school for like tuition and such. So I used some of the money to pay for that, and then I also used it for some school supplies. As an engineering student, I do need a computer to survive in college. So I did take out some money to use it to buy a new computer for those things, and I use it almost every day. So I'm glad about that.
Yeah. If you're just joining us, I'm speaking with Angel Griffith, a student of MSU and Ticket to Tuition scholarship winner. Also here, Ryan Fewins Bliss, Executive Director of MCAN. Ryan, do you find that the bigger hardships come with just a first tuition payment or other hurdles in later years as they're trying to get through their certifications or degree programs?
Yeah, there's a handful of things that we find that students, and this is traditional students or adult students, face once they get on campus. Things like academic readiness. Am I ready to take the courses? Am I able to do the work and be successful? There's a social component to this. Do I fit in here? Do I have friends? I sort of use the story like, if I disappeared from campus tomorrow, would anybody notice or care? When the answer to that is no, students often stop out. They just feel like they're not belonging there and that this isn't the place for them. So there's a social piece of that. And then again, more affordability. The tuition goes up every year. Do the scholarships tend to not go up in that way? So do I still have the money for years two, three, four, and beyond? Some colleges use a graduated tuition payment, so it actually gets more expensive as you stay in the college in the later years. And so again, there's more affordability problems there. And so those are a bunch of the barriers and the challenges that we see students face. There are some common themes.
Yeah, for sure. Angel, have you thought at all about what's gonna help you go the distance? I mean, you're at minimum, in this for a what I guess I shouldn't say a 4-year haul because some undergraduate programs really do take more than that. But is there anything else that has been on your mind about the years to come?
Actually, just as Ryan was saying, before I go to Michigan State. So before I came to Michigan State, I was also thinking like I only know a few people from my high school that are coming to Michigan State, and none of them are in engineering like I am. So like, am I going to know people on campus that like I can relate to in that aspect? And then just like having that circle of friends around, of people that like understand you, like the people in your hometown or something like that. Or even as he was saying about the tuition going up, because in high school I did dual enrollment, so I do have like some extra credits. And I came in as sophomore status, so when this year I looked at my tuition and it went up already because now I'm junior status. So I did have to take more money out of the scholarship this year than I did last year. So just things about that. I have even thought about like, am I going to be able to push myself to go the distance, as you were saying, just with the classes, because I know all majors have hard classes. Speaking from experience in engineering, first semester or second semester, I already felt the pressure of how hard the classes can be. And I know that they're only going to get harder from here. So,
For
yeah.
sure, for sure. Ryan, I wonder if there's anything you can tell us about parts of this project that are specifically designed to help people. I mean, I would be perfectly happy if there were 5,000 Angel Griffiths out there, but people who might be involved in trade programs or other kinds of professional certifications.
Yeah, I mean, we've got tens of thousands of students all across the state, folks like Angel at Michigan State University, but also folks at community colleges and other programs. We don't have a robust trade school system in Michigan like other states have. In Michigan, mostly our community colleges serve as our trade schools. You can get a certificate or associate's degree in welding or in construction trades. Which is actually great because then you qualify for the state-based aid for free community college in the state. So there's lots of programs and training going on. The real challenge that we have found is this pervasive myth in the zeitgeist that college is not important. There's no return on investment. You don't need to go to college. You'll graduate with $1 million in debt and never pay it off. And the data just says all the opposite, that if you want a ticket to a middle class life, it is getting a certificate or a degree. It is the way that you build wealth in modern society.
Yeah, well, I do have a teenager in the house myself, and I noticed that she and her friends, like a lot of times, they maybe think that they don't, that maybe the kind of education that a trade school or as you say, a community college in Michigan's case might offer, they might think that it's not for them. Do you think that there are things the state can do to sort of change the perception?
Yeah, the state has invested some money into doing some campaigns around the power of college. And when we talk about college at Michigan College Access Network, we talk about certificates, associates, bachelor's, and beyond, all of the things termed as college. So they're giving some grants out. MCAN is one of the organizations that got one to raise awareness in the communities that college still matters. College is important. So there'll be some formal campaigns around that. Part of the financial aid programs that are funded by the state come with some outreach dollars. So again, our friends at the state are doing things like that with our taxpayer dollars to make sure people know about these things. But really, what needs to change is our community's leaders, our folks who are running for office, Republicans and Democrats. We need to stop politicizing education. There is a need for education. It is overwhelming. We've got doctor shortages in northern Michigan. We have teacher shortages everywhere, school counselor shortages. We need people with certificates and degrees all across the state. That includes plumbers and welders and all of those folks as well. But instead of encouraging folks to not get a bachelor's degree to go get a certificate or not get a certificate and go get a bachelor's degree, we need to stop robbing from those buckets and start taking from the bucket of students who graduate high school and don't do any formal education, which is about 30% of our state. Those are the folks who are going to have a bigger struggle in life. We know those are the folks that we should be pulling into one of the other buckets. Come get a certificate, come get a degree, enter the workforce, engage in our economic system. It's better for you and it's better for the state.
Angel Griffith, having had the experience of a couple years in school now, is there anything that you look back on that you think is important either for other prospective students to know or people who are trying to encourage folks to consider their college options?
Yes. as Ryan was saying, like, I feel like programs are a big thing to helping students realize that going to school is more than just getting a degree or something like that. Like, it can pour so much more into your life as far as just learning more and getting a better opportunities for jobs. For me, that was Upward Bound, which was the college readiness program. And they really like did a lot to show us how college could help you in different kinds of ways. And we even like visited colleges, or we took trips to do some college experiences. I feel like programs like that really help students to realize, like, okay, maybe it's more to college than just like getting a degree. It can do other things in my life.
Angel Griffith is a student at Michigan State University in the College of Engineering and also the winner of one of the state's Ticket to Tuition scholarships. Angel, thank you so much for sharing some of your expertise with us on this.
Yes, no problem. I love to do this and share my experience with younger people that can take the things that I've done and apply it to their own life in any way that they need to.
We've also been talking with Ryan Fewins-Bliss, who directs the Michigan College Access Network, or MCAN. Ryan, thank you.
Thanks for talking about this. It's really critical to our state.
We're going to pause for just a minute now. After that,
people loved the flavors, but they were also like, oh my gosh, I have a guy, you know, with ice cream.
Thoughts on the queen of summer treats and how she brings us together. Up next, you're with Stateside. This is Stateside. I'm April Baer. We are wrapping up our ice cream week on the show, our tribute to summer's sweetest treat in these dog days of August. And today we're speaking with a craft ice cream maker whose shop in Ypsilanti demonstrated the unique and special place of the ice cream parlor in a community. Go Ice Cream carried flavors that you couldn't find anywhere else, like their signature sweet brown butter, and served Ypsilanti in Ann Arbor for a decade before this small business closed in the wake of COVID. We're going to talk about that in a minute. Rob Hess was the brains and the palate behind Go. He's actually now a digital content producer at Michigan Public, and that is how executive producer Laura Weber Davis snagged him for a sit-down interview about the story of making ice cream. Here's Laura's conversation with Rob.
I have not had the pleasure of asking you before how you got into making ice cream in the first place.
I've always cooked. I grew up cooking with my mom. And I just love sort of the way that food comes together. I love watching it change states as it cooks. And so for me, making ice cream, which is basically like a pudding at first, and then you churn it and it freezes and it changes states and it becomes more of a solid sort of thing and the experience becomes different. For me, that was just fascinating. And I fell in love with the process of making ice cream. And then there's so many different flavors that you can make. And, you know, I've always been a storyteller. And for me, the process of really looking at the stories behind where flavors came from and taking them sort of back to that root and telling a story to the customer or whoever's eating the ice cream through flavor, that's what really started it for me. So I started making it in my kitchen at home, and I started making so much ice cream because, you know, every weekend I would be buying, like, you know, 6 gallons of milk and 20 pounds of sugar. And then eventually my wife was like, honey, like, there's no room for the frozen peas in the freezer anymore. So we got to start giving this away. So I started giving it away to people that worked with me at the University of Michigan, and the reputation grew. So then suddenly people...
Wait, back up.
Yes.
You were an ice cream hobbyist.
I was a total hobbyist.
Like, I hear people of brewing beer, you know?
Yes.
Now, I don't know that I've met an ice cream hobbyist before.
And I think that's one of the things. People loved the flavors, but they were also like, oh my gosh, I have a guy, you know, with ice cream. And so people started to like schedule meetings in the conference room of our office, hoping that there would be free ice cream in the freezer because they had heard about this around campus.
Mooches.
It started that way. And then people started hiring me to do weddings and office events, all of which was totally illegal. I wasn't licensed to do any of that. And so I had to figure out how to make it legal and get a storefront and all of this stuff. But it started there. Just absolutely loved the storytelling aspect of it. And ice cream just has a way of bringing people together. I started selling it at farmers markets soon thereafter, you know, once I had made it legal.
How did you do that? Take dry ice?
Yeah, I had an ice cream tricycle, actually. So I bought an old Worksman tricycle, which used to be used to carry the tools up and down the line at a GM plant. And I retrofitted it with a cooler on the back of it so that I could bike ice cream around town. And I would bike up to these farmers markets in like full spandex, looking like a crazy 40-year-old guy in spandex selling ice cream off of a tricycle. And I would sell it there, and I would watch how, you know, two folks who probably wouldn't talk to each other normally at a farmer's market, if I was giving them both free samples of my sweet brown butter ice cream, suddenly they were both talking about their grandmothers, right? Like they were sharing stories about what the flavor reminded them of. And when I saw how it brought folks together like that and really brought out an emotional response in folks, I thought, uh-oh, this is something I could probably spend a lot of my life doing. Like this, this has some meaning to it.
How did you decide to make the leap from... well, it wasn't corporate world, but from like office life to I'm going to take the full leap and open up a business?
I couldn't stop thinking about it. I would dream about ice cream. And when I saw the way that it brought folks together like that, I thought this is something meaningful that I could do. I can really create community with this. I can really tell stories and connect to folks. You know, you look at, you know, how excited kids get when they have their first taste of ice cream. I was able to do that for hundreds, if not thousands of children, right? And I still see them on the streets, right? So for me, it was very personally fulfilling. The hardest part really was just taking that leap and trusting it. Part of that process for me and gaining the confidence to do it was I started a crowdfunding campaign because I needed a lot of money to create an ice cream manufacturing facility. And I thought, okay, well, if the town supports it, if people think this is a good idea, well, then I'll do it. And so I raised about $35,000 from about 300 donors over the course of a month. And that was when the scary part happened, because then I had to quit my job, you know, and I had to really make this leap. And it was terrifying, but I was so passionate about it and it was so fulfilling that I knew I had to do it.
Can you just rattle off some of your flavors?
Yeah. So my main flavors were three bean vanilla. So I used vanilla beans from Madagascar, Uganda, and Tahiti. I had chocolate sorbet, which was a dairy-free option. It was very thick and rich and fudgy. Probably the most popular ice cream flavor I've ever made that we always had was sweet browned butter. So it sort of tasted like butter pecan without the pecans. And that was one that if I didn't have it, people would go insane. So I just had to always have it. Some of my most popular ones, I have a friend that I met simply because he loved my carrot cake, and now we're extremely close friends. So I had a carrot cake ice cream that had a cream cheese ripple in it, spiced walnuts, candied carrots. I made everything absolutely from scratch, right? So I could really tweak the flavors as much as I wanted to. I had a red velvet ice cream where I went back and found historical recipes of how red velvet cake was first invented and how it was made in the South. And then I tweaked that, right? And so it was a red velvet cake ice cream base with pieces of red velvet cake handmade in it and cream cheese frosting in it. I mean, I probably had 120 plus flavors that I made.
What was your favorite? Not the best seller, but like what was your favorite that you ever made where you're like, this is kind of an aha moment for me?
I mean, probably the sweet browned butter, honestly. I mean, it's so hard to choose because I loved them all. It's
any like failures where you're like, wow, that really didn't work?
Oh, so many failures. I mean, it was just constant failures, right? I was dead set on coming up with a wasabi inclusion for ice cream somehow. Like, I gotta get this wasabi in here. So many things that I tried. I tried smoking pine branches into an ice cream base once for a campfire s'mores ice cream, pine branch is not a tasty, delicious flavor. Like, it doesn't, nobody wants that. I tried soaking hay. I was doing a like edible hay. I was doing like a sort of fall Halloween like hayride kind of vibe. I would get these ideas for like a story or a feeling I wanted to communicate and capture and connect with
people. I want it to taste like a memory, but literally the whole memory.
100%.
Including hay in your socks.
And then at some point you're like, wait a second, guy, nobody wants to eat hay. You know what? Like, cool idea, great concept. Nobody wants to try that.
No, they just want pumpkin spice. Let's be honest.
Yeah, I ate bugs for it, you know, which is obviously that's a protein source in a lot of the world. Yeah. There's nothing crazy about that. But
maybe not
everybody
ice cream.
Wants cricket legs on their tongue after they've licked their ice cream, especially not maybe, I don't know, a 5-year-old.
However, I used to love grasshopper cookies.
Oh, grasshopper cookies.
Now they didn't have grasshoppers in it. But
but how cool. See, that's exactly the kind of thing that I would follow. I'd be like, what if I took grasshopper protein?
Dipped them in chocolate and mint.
Yeah.
Sounds great.
You know, let's do it. Yeah.
Let's talk about when you knew the business wasn't going to work anymore.
Yeah.
I seem to recall that things started to, like, maybe you put your announcement out not long after COVID?
Yeah, we made it a couple years after COVID, actually. I was able to reconfigure during COVID so that the business came out even better off financially.
Yeah.
Because I had my dairy manufacturer license instead of just a food service license. So I could really ramp up production for grocery stores, et cetera, during that time. And I could do everything myself. So I was able to keep my staff safe during COVID and run everything myself and make the sales. It was a lot of work, but the business was in better shape afterwards. The real problem was the downtown landscape really changed around us. People went out less. And we're sort of a second destination, right? You kind of want to get some food or go to a park or whatever and then come get ice cream. And so while we did draw our own folks, they generally want to do something in addition to getting ice cream, right? And so that was a big part of it. And then also there was a summer where the city of Ypsilanti just had several downtown businesses close after COVID, and there was a lot of road construction. And so they sort of shut down Main Street. They shut down our parking lot. You know, there was just more difficult to get to us. So we were going into that summer projected to come out with a profit of a good number for us. And a profit in a small seasonal ice cream business is tough to come by. But we were really coming out ahead, from pretty conservative projections. And then as we started to get into the summer and they closed the roads, that changed. And we were set to lose probably about $90,000 over the course of the summer. And we were 10 years into running the business. And my wife and I just felt like, you know, we really can't continue to support this in this way. So it was an incredibly agonizing decision for me. And I still have folks come up to me teary-eyed. It's 3 years later now. You know, whenever I go to this one grocery store in town, I'm pretty much guaranteed that someone will approach me and say, like, you know, we miss your ice cream so much. And it's mutual, right? I really miss what it allowed me to do and the ways it allowed me to connect with folks. But I also carry a lot of gratitude for the fact that I was able to do that.
What do you think it is about ice cream that just like makes people feel so joyful and just like nostalgic or positive?
We don't always allow ourselves a lot of sweet treats, right? And usually ice cream, you're adding it on to something, you know, you're adding it on to a fun time or a great day, you know, it's an addition. And so I think part of it is just that there's fun memories associated with it because you're doing other fun things. And you're allowing yourself, there's no nutritional value with ice cream. You are just allowing yourself to do something purely for the pleasure of it, right? Just because it's silly and tastes great and you just want it and you're letting yourself have that. And so I think it's really that. Also, just, you know, as speaking as somebody who has studied the molecular composition of ice cream. I will say it is an extremely efficient flavor delivery mechanism.
Totally. It's just all flavor in licks, cold licks.
Yes, it's the fats melt on your tongue really quickly. They carry a ton of flavor with them. And so it just all goes into your olfactory senses and you are like charged with flavor. So I think part of it is just a wallop of flavor, but also just it's fun.
Yeah.
Yeah.
What do you miss most about it?
It allowed me to really make people's day. Every person who came in the door, you know, and I would tell the staff, you know, every person that comes in, we actually do get to make their day better. Like it, and it was, sometimes the staff would work too hard because they enjoyed that so much and they took it so seriously, right? It felt so good. When someone's coming in for ice cream, we were able to meet them in a state that kind of exists between childhood and adult, right?
100%.
I mean, I would see folks come in because they were having a bad day. And then later on, that same person would come in at night with their wife and get ice cream and look at me like, don't you dare tell them I was here this afternoon, you know?
Because now I'm here because it's a good day and we're happy.
Yeah, exactly. And then there was one customer who it was, you know, New Year's Eve and we had just closed. It was after our first year. I was selling peppermint ice cream pies for the season. We had exactly one left in the freezer, and I was so stoked, like, oh, my wife and I get to have this. I can't wait to dig into it. We had closed the doors early, or not early. We closed at 5 because it was New Year's Eve, and the staff and I were cleaning up. My wife and I just wanted to go home and get our holiday started, and this person comes and pulls on the door. It's locked, and you can see he walks away sort of dejected. And I opened the door and I said, hey, did you need anything? Oh, no. I just wanted to get one of those ice cream pies. Don't worry about it. I hope you guys have a great holiday. I said, oh, you know what, man? There's one in here. You know, you're our very last customer of the first year we were open. I'm just going to give you this pie for free. And he burst into tears. His father had just passed away. And it was his dad's favorite flavor was peppermint ice cream. And he was coming because he wanted to get that. And so I was able to have a big impact on that person's life, right? That's a memory that person will carry forever, and it's a memory I carry, so I miss that. I was able to do that, I'm telling you, literally hundreds of times a day. Some days, thousands of times a day, I was able to do that for folks.
That is so incredible, Rob. That's going to make me feel misty, and we're talking about ice cream.
You can cry. There is crying in ice cream. I've proven it.
Do you still make ice cream at home?
I don't. I'm finally getting to a place where I'm ready to start making ice cream again. I put a lot of myself into it, right? And I put so much of myself into ice cream that I think I forgot who I was outside of ice cream for a while. And I've just kind of been rediscovering that. I mean, that's a heavy answer for an ice cream interview, but, you know, that's the truth, right? I needed to refigure out who I was again. And so I think ice cream and I've been buying more pints of Ben and Jerry's lately. So I think I'm ready to come back to it.
And don't start bringing ice cream in here because we'll turn into a bunch of heathens. So
I'm very careful about where I wield my ice cream.
Please do not bring it in here. I don't want you to feel like we're scheduling meetings around your ice cream making schedule.
Power dynamics happen.
Yeah. If you get back into it, you do it for yourself.
Thank you. I will.
I'll bring you some Edie's.
I'll never turn down free ice cream. Are you kidding me?
I know, me either. Like, I'm like, sure. I don't even like that brand.
It
but yeah.
Sounded like you meant that as a threat, but actually it was an offer.
It's like, yeah, it's like pizza.
Yeah.
There's good pizza and bad pizza, but I'll eat it all. All right, Rob, I have one more question for you.
Please.
What is the flavor profile of Blue Moon ice cream?
Great question. It is many things.
That is unsatisfactory. When you were studying this.
Yes.
Now, as you said, you would not go to a company and order Blue Moon flavoring if you were going to make it.
No, but they make it.
And that's what most people use.
Yes.
If you were going to make Blue Moon today at home, what flavoring would you use? What flavor profile would you use?
So I did make a Blue Moon ice cream. And so I have researched it. It is a melange of several different flavors. And generally speaking, those flavors are...
drum roll.
Yeah.
Okay. Okay.
Generally speaking, what you're getting is lemon, vanilla, almond, and sometimes a little raspberry.
There you have it, folks. Mm-hmm. It's this is deep investigative journalism. Thank you, Rob.
You're so welcome. Thank you.
That was Rob Hess, former owner of Go Ice Cream in Ypsilanti. He is now a digital producer at Michigan Public, and we are so happy that this is where he landed, even if he never actually whips up a batch of homemade ice cream for us. Rob spoke with Stateside executive producer Laura Weber Davis. That's Stateside for today. I'm April Baer. Thank you for listening. We wish you the sweetest of scoops. See you Monday.